coming down the pike. A good example of that is the EPA's release last week of their proposed regulations on for new facilities on greenhouse gas emissions. And they're supposed to, or they will, issue proposed regs on existing plants, which is going to be much more impactful to the state. Look for that to come out. Our latest intelligence says that's not going to come out until after the elections, which I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't. So late fall, look for those to come out. They will have impacts. And, you know, given our mandate, the infrastructure's mandate on clean coal and advanced fuel technologies, we are in the process of formulating a initiative on clean coal and sequestration, working in cooperation with lots of other entities in the state, like the university and others. Part of that initiative is to just apprise our stakeholders of what's happening around the country. We have currently there's three new carbon capture and sequestration facilities under development. Two of those are under construction. Two of them are post-combustion relative to existing plants. A few months ago, myself, Brian, and another gentleman, Brian Jeffries and another gentleman, toured the NRG facility down in near Houston, their Parrish facility. They're retrofitting about 250 megawatts of coal generation to capture CO2 and use that CO2 for enhanced oil recovery. There's another facility in Saskatchewan that's doing the same thing. And there's a new facility down in Mississippi that's capturing CO2. So we're going to be following that. We're going to be making sure that everybody in our state's apprised of that activity. I would invite the committee to our board meeting on the 23rd and 24th. We're devoting all the 23rd to clean coal and advanced fuel technology. So you're invited to that. And I think that concludes my summary of what we're working on, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions, committee?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Dockstader.
Sir, you mentioned you're marketing to California. How do we market to California now in the changing environment?
Lloyd.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we've tried to arm ourselves with ammunition as we go out there in terms of we've got a WEC study that came out in 2011 that showed California can benefit to the tune of over $600 million a year. California ratepayers could save that amount of money by allowing out-of-state transmission to deliver renewable energy to the state. We've commissioned a geographic diversity study, several of them from the University of Wyoming. Great results. I mean, as we experience every day, we have a lot of wind here in the state. So, and it blows much differently than it blows in California. So combining Wyoming wind with California wind and solar definitely, again, smooths out that variability. And then at our board meeting on the 24th here in Cheyenne of this month, we're presenting a new grid integration study that NREL has been working on that is going to show some great results, and we'll be using that in our outreach efforts to California.
Representative Stubbs.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Green, what is the current state then in California as far as their allowing out-of-state producers of renewables access to the market?
Lloyd.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, one thing I do point out to them when I meet with them, and we've met with legislators and governors, officials, and is that they're already importing some wind and solar. The renewables are Jerry Brown's, Governor Brown's renewables are a gentleman named Michael Picker. He's always left the door open for us. Certainly, they want to build those facilities in-state to get those benefits. But it is so compelling what we have to offer, and that compelling value proposition just continues to build with these studies that we commission and information in the marketplace. They just, you know, within the last year, they shut down their Songs nuclear generation facility. That was 2,200 megawatts. They've got a drought going on out there, so their hydroelectric power. So we remain confident that we're going to get at least one of these lines built.
And Mr. Chairman, does it require a change in their regulatory environment to allow, that power to flow into California system?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, their existing legislation, I mean, we Wyoming and these transmission projects that we have under development, they qualify as in-state equivalent because they're DC lines, and part of the legislation that was passed that raised California's RPS, their renewable portfolio standard, to 33%. It said that, you know, any power that's connected has to be, the first point of connection has to be into California. So we qualify for that. I mean, these DC lines, that is the first point of interconnect into the CAISO system south of Vegas. So,
okay.
Okay. One of the questions I have, and if you got into it while I was gone, I apologize, and we can talk later if you already explained it to the committee, is, you know, we have X amount of takeaway capacity with our transmission lines. So many, we can take out so much electricity, and I think the number that we have is of the electricity produced in our state, we export 85% of it. So there's some number there. I'm interested in that number. And then what I'm interested in is given what's going on with wind, what capacity do we lack in terms of getting it out with our transmission lines? And then the other thing you didn't mention, we have the impact of no new coal-fired power plants. Certainly, I think we're going to be impacted by what they do later on this fall, but the regional haze rule that just came out has a negative impact on, I think, four of our coal-fired power plants, Wyodak, Dave Johnston, Jim Bridger, and the one in Wheatland. And so if they, in fact, require that billion-dollar expenditure that does nothing, those power plants may, in fact, decide to shut down some of their units. And if they do, what does that do to the transmission lines we have going out relative to potential wind development? So I'm not sure you can answer that question right now, Lloyd, but what I'm trying to get is a big picture of what we have, what's going on, what we might see with the wind, what these other lines would do, so I can get a better feel. Like what we had with the pipelines, it's pretty easy. We got 10 BCF a day takeaway. We're producing 7. Where are we with electricity? That's what I'm getting at.
Mr. Chairman, how about I file a report following this meeting that addresses all your questions?
Yeah, that'd be fine. Just give us submit that to us. And what we're trying to do is figure out, like everything else we do in business, the tangible results received from your hard work, and how you can reflect that in terms of what's happened in the last 3 or 4 years. You know, it just gives us an idea of the benefits to the money spent relative to what we see, the improvements, or how our state's going in a better direction, what's going on in a positive way. It's just like anything else, and you've been around a long time. It's just justification of from a business perspective of the money spent and what we receive for it.
We'll do that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Meyer.
But, you know, that 3 or 4 years might be a short time period, because I can remember when I met with people from Pacific Corp out in Salt Lake City maybe 10, 12 years ago on the lines that they're just getting built now. And that was when the Infrastructure Authority was just put together. So it's these things are on a time period that necessarily isn't relative to 3 or 4 years because of the length of the time it takes to think about whether the line is needed, to get all of the NEPA processes, to go through and jump through all of the hoops. It's a longer time frame than 3 or 4 years because I can say the work that the Infrastructure Authority did in its infancy, helped with those transmission lines that are now being slated by Pacific Corps because of the work that was done in Salt Lake years ago. You know, so those are, you know, I guess the timeline I'm a little bit concerned about as far as whether or not you can look at the tangible results, because it's perhaps too short, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Lloyd. Do you have a response?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I appreciate those comments, and you're right. But at the same time, we welcome the opportunity to report tangible results that we've seen as a result of our hard work. So I'm happy to file that report and share with the committee the work that we're doing and some of the results thereof.
Okay, any other questions in general about the Infrastructure Authority? Okay, let's do your budget. If you would please go through page by page.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to start with page 3, if that's okay.
Yes, sir.
That's just a summary. Our budget request is $1.62 million for the biennium. That's made up of several different series of expenditures, supportive services, data services, non-operating expenditures, and contractual services, which we also refer to as professional services. And that's by far and away the bulk of our budget. So I would, if it's okay, I would go through. I'm going to skip the narrative. Hopefully I've covered a lot of that in my discussion. I'm going to go to page 7. The only 2 seconds, Mr. Chairman. The only budget exception that we have is for a server software that has been that expenditure or $3,600 that is, like I said, for a server and the software to support it. It aligns with ETS's replacement policy for that type of equipment. It's been approved by ETS and by the governor, and total $3,606.
You mentioned ETS. How's your relationship been with them, and have you utilized any of their services other than for this?
My opinion is that our relationship, Mr. Chairman, is with them is very good. They're very responsive to our needs, and if we have breakdowns or they've been, I'd give them an A+.
Okay. Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman and Lloyd, looking at your 400 series, it looks like it decreased by an amount roughly comparable to what you're asking for as the exception request. Is there a relationship between that increase and that decrease and the increase in your 200 series?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, only in as much as it applies to ETS, but yes, our series 400 has been reduced by an amount a little in excess of that 3606.
Okay. Continue.
Mr. Chairman, I've moved to page 8. That's just a little brief org chart. Ours is small. We've got a 5-member board of directors.
We've
got one with me today.
Would you give us the names of the other four, please?
Sure. Chairman Mike Easley, he's been our chairman since day one. We were formed in 2004. Kyle White is our vice chairman. Bryce Freeman is our secretary treasurer. J.M. Schaefer resides in Windsor, Colorado, former administrator for Western Area Power Administration, WAPA, and former general manager of Tri-State, so he brings with him a wealth of knowledge. And our newest member is Dave Sparks. Dave's in the transportation business, resides in Jackson Hole, but provides, even though he doesn't have an energy background, he does provide good perspective and to our board. So we have good board. We have great board members. They're all engaged, and I lean on them every day.
You know, Mike is came to the a group of us last week talking about a project they're working on, CO2 capture for tertiary. Are you familiar with that at all, and what he's trying to put together there with the Tri-State out of Colorado and some other people?
Mr. Chairman, yes, sir. We've got Tri-State speaking at our board meeting on the 23rd about their XPRIZE that deals with carbon capture. And again, you know, and I'm not trying to plug our board meetings, Mr. Chairman, but our board meetings are more like energy conferences. They present a great overview of what's happening in a lot of areas with energy in our state. So, and the fact that we're starting to videotape those are available on our website. So, great information. But yes, we have Tri-State coming, talking about building a purse of money to provide some incentive to capture that CO2. And like I said before, we are formulating a new initiative on carbon capture and sequestration, and that may well be part of that initiative.
Yeah, Don, what we need to do, and you were there, I think, when they made that presentation, were you not, to the management council or a group of us?
I was not.
You missed that. We need to get a hold of those people and I think have them give us a summary of their report, because there's an expenditure in there that they're going to be looking at. And I don't know if, Brett, if the governor's office is on board or looked at this at all. He's had a chance to talk to the people about this concept, but we need to get some information and get that to us if we do markup next week, if we need some callbacks or something to talk about it, because it's a sizable amount of money. I think it's $14 to $16 million for the plant. In committee, what it is, real quick, like, and is that they've got private industry has come up with a $10 million prize, if you will, for people to put together a plan on how to capture carbon CO2 from these power plants, of existing power plants. So it's not another research grant where we're going to do theory. It's actually applied technology where they will come with a proposal to a group of people to try to get the prize. And then if you win the prize, which you do is you develop a prototype that actually bolts onto a power plant to demonstrate that this works to capture CO2 in an economical way. And, of course, they need what they're looking at is they'll come up with a $10 million prize money. They'll do the evaluation to see who, in fact, should qualify, if anybody even does. Hopefully there'll be a lot of competition. And then the state will come in and apply the $14, $16, $18 million to build this demonstration plant that bolts on to an existing power plant. There's a lot of questions, a lot of things that need to be talked about before we move ahead. But is that a pretty good summary of what it is, Lloyd?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So, Don, I'd like to, and Brett, you know, let's see where the governor is. You know, if he doesn't like it, then I guess we need to know why. It seemed like a reasonable idea. Where to find the money is always a question. And, Don, I think we probably need to hear from those people a more specific thing. If Mike's going to be in town for a board meeting, you say Thursday of this week?
The Thursday of
next week.
A week from next Thursday. Yeah, actually, he's coming in on Wednesday. So a week from Wednesday, he'll be here Wednesday afternoon, Thursday, and Friday. 22nd, 23rd, 24th.
Let's see if we can facilitate if we need to have him come in. You know, we might hear from him for a little bit then and see what. And the governor could coordinate that, Brett, so we could have everybody sort of on the same page as to where we think we want to go. And I guess if the governor likes it, we'll get a letter from him. Have you talked to him at all about this, or do you have any comments?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'll just need to follow up with the governor's office on where they stand on this, as well as I'll follow up with Lloyd.
Okay. How's the committee feel about that? Are you interested in seeing that and pursuing that, or at least seeing where we stand? Sue, what do you think? You know, it really relates to coal. You know, and what we might do is have you come back with Mike, too, and see how this all ties together and what it does and the potential and all of that. Go ahead. Do you have a comment?
No, we'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chairman. And I do think it would be good if we could have that opportunity.
Okay. All right. We'll do that, Don. And get all that headed and started and see where we go. Okay, continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Still on page 8, our five-member board of directors. And I would like to point out that we have two employees, myself and a communication/administration person, Holly Martinez. And I'm proud of the work we do. And we got our fingers in lots of things, and we hope to the benefit of the state of Wyoming. But a lot of diverse activities. It's a great challenge on my part, but we're doing a lot of good things, in my opinion, with few people. I'm going to skip page 9, Mr. Chairman. That's pretty much that summary. And if I could, sir, go over to page 16.
Any questions on any of the other pages, committee? Okay, 16.
16 just, Mr. Chairman, provides detail on Series 200. It's got our exception request in there of 3606, again, which has been approved by ETS and by the governor. Again, our total budget is $1.620.032 million. Next page. The next page has an adjustment to our budget that Representative Stupson referred to, the Series 400 reduction of $4,000 for our biennium period. And, Mr. Chairman, other than that, I would just like to say we appreciate the funding that we do get. We think we use it wisely, and we'd appreciate consideration of granting this budget that we've requested.
Okay, thank you, Lloyd, for a very good report. Anything else, committee? Excuse me, anything else? Don, let's be communicating with him on this to get that other thing set up. And okay, thank you very much. If there's no questions, that'll conclude that. And we're going to take about let's be back at 10:45.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Enhanced Oil Recovery Institute. David, welcome. You heard my comments to the previous people that presented to us. We'd like to have you give an overview. And Bruce, welcome. And Pepper and Tom. And anything you want to say, Bruce, or anyone else, please feel free to do it. Then we'll go through your budget page by page. So welcome. The floor is yours.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does everybody have the handout that we provided? I'd like to just step through this as an overview. The Enhanced Oil Recovery Institute and the Enhanced Oil Recovery Commission were created by the legislature in 2004. Our mission is to assist Wyoming operators with recovering what we term stranded oil. I don't know if all of you are petroleum engineers or petroleum geologists, so I'll just go through a little fundamental background. There you go. So typical oil reservoir, there are different periods of development. When you see pictures from the turn of the 20th century with gushers, that's an illustration of primary production where you're producing from the energy in the reservoir. Usually that period of production lasts a short period of time, and the pressure is depleted, and then we implement secondary production, which is water injection. Water injection became a common practice as early as the 1920s. What the Enhanced Oil Recovery Institute focuses on is what traditionally has been termed tertiary production. So what do we do with mature oil fields that have really high water cuts and really low oil cuts? We have a lot of those in Wyoming, mature oil fields. In fact, about 90% of our production comes from mature oil fields, older than 25 years old, obsolete equipment. And so we're in the business of benchmarking, understanding the latest with regard to technology, how to apply it to Wyoming oil fields, working with Wyoming operators. And so that's the background. As far as recovering oil, it's typical to recover about 10% of the oil in the reservoir with primary production, maybe another 20 at most with secondary production. So we only recover about 30% of the oil through traditional techniques. So that means 70% of it's still down there. The chairman, Chairman Bebout, referred to 1 to 2 billion barrels of incremental oil in the Bighorn Basin with CO2 EOR. That's tertiary oil that we can recover, and I think the average water cut from fields in the Bighorn Basin right now is about 98%, 98.5%, which means they're still making money. Marathon's still making money up there, producing 1.5% oil. So they're really in the water business, and they just pay for it with the oil business. When we go back and look at implementing tertiary recovery, and there are many different kinds of advanced technology, carbon dioxide flooding is only one of them, we can recover another 10%, which is a really big number if you look at Wyoming's historical production of 7 billion barrels of oil. So think about producing another 3.5 billion barrels of oil. Okay? So we'll get into production curves. The first slide that I have given you are photographs, and it shows Salt Creek in the early part of the 20th century. And actually, these two pictures show a tremendous technical revolution. So if you look at the bottom picture, you see wooden derricks, and they were drilled with cable tool rigs. Senator Bebout probably knows what a cable tool rig is, if others have.
Well, the one I want to know is where Mr. Co-Chair Harshman, who worked in the oil field, which one of those wells he worked on. Although you're not quite that old yet.
It's that one on the bottom left corner. I actually did a pull job on that one on the corner.
There you go.
Actually, single pull job up in there.
I wasn't there, but I heard stories about it. Yeah. So the picture on the upper left-hand side, you see metal rigs, and rotary drilling had been invented by the 1920s. And actually, rotary drilling was what made development of Oregon Basin possible in the early part of the 20th century. Move to the right, and you can see the innovation. That's how we've developed. And That's a picture of Pinedale, the Pinedale Anticline electric rigs. And with these electric rigs, I've seen up to 24 wells drilled from one rig set. So they drill like a spider with horizontal wells out. Now, that's quite a change from those early pictures. And what I would add is that three things have made our business much better, our oil business much better. Horizontal drilling, 3D seismic, and improved stimulation, including improved hydraulic fracturing. Hydraulic fracturing has been around since 1948, so we're just using it better. What Larry Lake, a well-known professor from the University of Texas, told us was all those three things have really helped us, but higher oil prices have helped us a lot, too. So with higher oil prices, we can afford to use more of our advanced technology, and that's what we do every day. Okay? Our reason for being is to bring better technology to Wyoming operators. If we go to the next slide, you can start seeing some of the impacts of our work. This slide with the big blue wedge at the bottom is a plot of Wyoming oil production since 1980. And what you can see is that production declined from about 120 million barrels of oil a year down to about 60. And we've actually reversed the decline, so we're actually increasing in production. And there are multiple reasons for that. If you look at the bottom blue, that's a reflection of conventional and unconventional development. So when you hear about shale plays like the Niobrara and others, the upturn in the blue shown in 2012 is the beginning of the impact of increased development with unconventional recovery. The red wedge represents condensate production from unconventional gas reservoirs, and the green wedge illustrates oil that comes from enhanced oil recovery. Most of the oil produced from enhanced oil recovery is produced by carbon dioxide enhanced oil recovery in the state of Wyoming. That wedge represents 12% of our total production.
You know, and the other thing, too, Dave, about that for the committee, and I'm sure most of you are aware of it, that's so critical is the infrastructure is already there. I mean, the wells have been drilled. We know the reservoir. We know the original oil in place. We do not have to have extensive EISs and deal with our federal bureaucracy through the BLM and all of that. So it really gives you a leg up in terms of just timing to be able to get in there and get things done. Steve, can you imagine at Salt Creek if you'd have had to go through an environmental impact statement to come out there and do tertiary recovery there? You know, who knows how long it would have taken to be able to do that. So it's ready-made to go. All you got to do is get the CO2 to the proper place. Go ahead.
So,
Mr. Chairman, could I just ask a question on that, on the green wedge, on that CO2? I mean, where's the biggest chunk of that? Is it the Salt Creek? Is that the biggest play going on, CO2? And what's next, I guess?
That's a great segue to the next slide.
Oh, right on. Okay.
Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Co-Chairman. Basically, the next plot shows cumulative production, including Rangeley, which is a field in Colorado. All of the carbon dioxide that's been used to develop these projects has come from LaBarge, from Exxon's Shoe Creek gas plant. And so you can see the relative contributions. And we don't see Grieve on there yet, but we soon will. Gas injection in Grieve was initiated earlier this year. So there's usually a lag to see a response to carbon dioxide injection of at least a year, sometimes up to 18 months, 24 months. So we'll see Grieve built on top.
You know, Mr. Chairman, just to the other piece of this is, you know, there's the not only the oil produced, but just the jobs that, you know, like the work that's been done in Salt Creek, just to go into those old wells, recase them, reseal them, the whole thing. I mean, I guess the only downside might be for the electrical generation where there's no pump jacks anymore.
Right.
I mean, there's just no electricity pumping anymore. It's just totally pressuring it out. There's been a ton of work. There's rigs all over just constantly redoing these old wells.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Actually, you see the electricity on that CO2 compression end.
Yeah,
that's where you
go.
Get your energy.
Yeah.
So it's being invested
right.
At LaBarge instead of Salt Creek.
Yeah.
If you could go back to the first plot, I would like to put into perspective what a billion barrels of oil means to the state. So Chairman Bebout mentioned that the Bighorn Basin has potential to produce an incremental 1 to 2 billion barrels of oil. Let's assume that production happens over a 40-year period. That translates to 50 million barrels of oil a year. I'm sorry. Yeah, 50 million a year. And if you compare where our current production is in Wyoming, we're at 60 million a year. So 50 million a year for 40 years. And it won't be flat. The production profile won't be flat, but it simplifies the example.
What's an MCF of CO2 worth? I mean, you can't. Those are private transactions that occur between Exxon and different people as well as Denbury. But what do you think an MCF of CO2 is selling for?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, between $1.50 and $2 an MCF, and it floats with the price of oil. Okay. Carbon dioxide actually costs a bit less in Wyoming than it does in Texas. Market demand has driven up the cost of carbon dioxide in West Texas in the Permian Basin. So we operate 8 floods, if you include all 5 that are in barrel oil. We operate 8 floods here in Wyoming. New Mexico and Texas, there are 63 floods operating. It's a much larger business. It's an order of magnitude larger than ours.
You know, another thing that I think would be beneficial to the committee is you have your initial, and just take a field, and it needs 10 million cubic feet of MCF a day and so many tons. But once it's up and running, how much is residual and you continue to use, so the demand shrinks on what you need because you reuse it? What are some of those numbers?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Typically, you recycle, a rule of thumb would be a half. Half of the carbon dioxide that's injected will come back out and be reused with each cycle. So actually, the carbon dioxide gets trapped in the reservoir, gets trapped in the oil because it gets absorbed by the oil, gets trapped by capillary forces in the reservoir. So we constantly have to add carbon dioxide to floods, but there is peak consumption occurs during the first 2 years, and then it trails off. But what's typically happened in Wyoming floods is they'll move the carbon dioxide around in the field because we don't have enough carbon dioxide to develop everything at once. So Salt Creek's a good example of that, where they've flooded different portions of the fields at different times. Just to go back to what Chairman Harshman asked, is how many jobs result from implementation of these projects. If we produced a billion barrels of oil over 40 years, we're talking about tens of thousands of jobs. Our economics department did a study based on the Bighorn Basin. We can share the results of that with you, but I think the incremental jobs peaked early and then kind of trailed off, and they were still above an incremental 10,000 jobs. Not just primary jobs, but secondary and tertiary jobs. So it means revenue to states and counties. It means jobs. And it means extending the life of these fields for decades. So that's just carbon dioxide. I have other technologies that we look at, but this is the big one in Wyoming right now.
Sue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the... first of all, where's Beaver Creek and Monell? Just don't know where they are.
Yeah, Representative, Beaver Creek's close to Riverton. That was my first job out of school, working in Beaver Creek. I drilled a lot of the 10 sleep wells there. And Monell is located along I-80 near Rollins.
Oh, yeah.
So close to Table Rock, between Table Rock and Rollins.
So, Mr. Chairman, my follow-up question would be, is the location of these old mature fields being enhanced with this a function of where the carbon dioxide is available?
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Okay, so
yes,
therefore... Therefore, our discussion about the bolt-on carbon capture in the coal fields of northeastern Wyoming could have huge benefits for our mature oil fields that are all around there.
They are, and not just in the Powder River Basin and all the basins where there are coal. One of the things, too, we did along that vein, Sue, was I think when Denbury originally designed that line to take the CO2 from Madden unit, which is in eastern Fremont County, that they were going to take they're taking it to Montana. Yeah, to Bell Creek, but they expanded that from an 8-inch to a 20-inch line, nodding our heads, and that's because of the additional capacity of CO2. And part of that was going to come from Rawlins, DKRW, if that ever materializes. And, you know, that's a whole other discussion. But there's capacity there, and that pipe's in the ground now from central Wyoming to head up to the PRB. We just got to get it to get the CO2 to that pipe.
So Brian Jeffries talked about our cooperative efforts. To go back to your point, we've looked at all potential sources of carbon dioxide, including coal conversion, and we've looked at the places it can be used. And when we define the right-of-ways that are going to be permitted, all of those things are considered. So any place that we had to cross public lands, there have been right-of-ways defined, and that'll be part of the permitting project. The biggest benefit of that permitting project is you'll take 2 to 3 years out of a 7-year project cycle. So we actually spend more time permitting projects than building and implementing them in Wyoming on public lands.
And then one other thing, too, Representative Wallace, is he mentioned where Beaver Creek is, and there, because of the pipe that was put in by an independent taking from Jeffrey City, the CO2 to there, their production went from like 400 barrels a day to 5,000 barrels a day. They now have, because of the reuse of the CO2, they have the opportunity to go to another field out there, Big Sand Draw, I think is what it's called, and Devon now has bought that and are looking at CO2. They're drilling some wells there, so it just kind of grows, and we should see the same kind of results there, hopefully.
Having been on the screening committee back in the old days, that was another Amoco field, Mr. Chairman. Yes. There are a lot of good projects in Wyoming. So we're aware of about 8 more that could be implemented if we can find the carbon dioxide to do it, and if we can get it from the source to the place it needs to be used. Those are projects that could be implemented in the next 3 to 5 years. I just came back from a meeting in West Texas. The folks in North Dakota and Montana are saying they have 20 projects. And so they have a significant effort that they could implement to use carbon dioxide as well. The next page of the handout talks about our program. And we implement research and applied research to help Wyoming operators use technology. We do a number of things. We complete research ourselves. I'll show you how our staff has grown on the next slide. So we do work within ERI. We have a new lab in the new Energy Innovation Center where we have 5 folks working. We fund faculty. So faculty and graduate students do work that's aligned with our strategy, and we've been improving that alignment over the last 3 years. We go to meetings, mostly in the United States, a few international meetings, where we learn what's going on as far as best practices go. And then we bring all that back to Wyoming and share that with Wyoming operators through our workshops, our conferences, and we're soon going to implement forums as well. So those of you who are from Casper will probably know we have a very large carbon dioxide conference in July. It's the largest in the world. No one attracts more people than we do. We eclipsed our mentor in West Texas as far as participation goes 2 years ago, much to Glenn's credit. We've done 2 to 3 workshops a year where we invite oil companies to participate, and they contribute significantly to the content. They actually develop case studies and share information that's never been shared before. We're seeing a change of culture from the 80s where even the large companies, where everyone kept everything a secret, proprietary. Now we're seeing companies like Marathon and Chevron sharing because they don't perceive that the disadvantage of losing competitive advantage, the advantage of sharing the information exceeds that disadvantage of losing competitive advantage. And so that's good. We also support strategic planning with the state, so working with the governor's office, with the Minerals Committee, with the Pipeline Authority, we help support longer-term planning. The next plot is a bar chart that illustrates our staffing. We currently have 19 staff and more part-time staff and interns. What it shows, the dark blue bars show growth of full-time technical staff from 7 in 2010 to 14 in 2013. Our administrative staff stayed the same. So we're doing more work and doing it with the same amount of administration. The way that we funded this growth was to reallocate funds that were given to faculty to ERI. So we still support faculty, just not to the extent that we did in 2009. Part of this growth is reflected in the addition of our state-of-the-art research lab, and that allows us to evaluate Wyoming reservoir rocks, oil, and water, and support Wyoming projects with proper research. Examples of projects are listed on the next page, and the results of those projects. One of our key metrics is to increase booked reserves in the state. We've been very conservative about taking credit for increased reserves. We've taken credit for 21 million barrels of oil that will translate to $150 million in increased ad valorem and severance taxes. Those two projects are Timber Creek, which is a redeveloped water flood in the Bighorn Basin. It's in a Menalusa Reservoir. Powder River Basin, sorry. Thanks, Bruce. And the Grieve Field, which we just initiated, which Denbury just initiated CO2 injection into early this year. So we anticipate that an incremental 21 million barrels will be recovered from those two projects. Timber Creek is one of three fields that are included in our Menalusa Consortium right now. We anticipate seeing additional development in the other two fields, and we anticipate increasing the number of fields we're looking at through that consortium. It's matured over the past 4 years, and I'd say we're picking up steam. The Institute has been central to characterization of residual oil zones in all over the state. The big ones have been identified in the Bighorn Basin associated with the Ten Sleep reservoirs. Residual oil zones exist beneath what we have always considered to be the main pay zones that we've produced. So residual oil zones were always considered to be not attractive to develop, and that's because you really can't produce commercial amounts of oil using primary and secondary recovery, but you can with tertiary recovery. There are currently 11 commercial ROZ projects in West Texas. So it's a proven concept. It's just a matter of applying the same concepts to our reservoirs. What we need is to be able to transport carbon dioxide from its source to the Bighorn Basin to accomplish that. I've already talked about benchmarking best practices. We've talked about CO2 pipeline right-of-ways. We have continuing conversations with companies that want to invest in Wyoming. One of the largest pipeline companies in the world just approached me to help them scope building a new CO2 pipeline. We've actually had two different consortiums approach us, one who wants to build a pipeline from North Dakota south to Wyoming, and another that would like to build pipelines from the south north. So that's good. We've also had new operators look at fields. We do between 7 and 10 scoping feasibility studies every year for companies from all over the world who want to invest in Wyoming enhanced oil recovery operations. And then lastly, I've listed the RMPs, the resource management plans that BLM completes. I'd say we're integral in working with BLM now. When we evaluated the Bighorn Basin RMP. We developed a relationship with BLM's Reservoir Engineering Group in Casper. So I expect to see a lot more coordination and consideration of enhanced oil recovery when they develop their RMPs.
And members of the committee, just to speak a little bit about that, that was one of the real, and Tim, you were on minerals and Glenn was on minerals, and remember we had that meeting in Riverton, and we had the Bighorn Basin RMP people down with the BLM, and somebody mentioned pipelines and CO2, and they had this blank stare on their face, and they hadn't even considered it. And at the same time, I believe we, and I'm on the commission, we'd had a meeting, Tom, and you brought that up since you were, you know, up there and operating up there and understood the potential. And EORI was really instrumental in getting up to speed and providing that information. And the BLM, just more or less everything you recommended, they went along with. It really, really worked and opened their eyes to the huge potential of that. It really worked. Good job on that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next slide summarizes participants in our workshops. We implemented a new workshop program 2 years ago. We decided to focus the two workshops on the two most prolific reservoirs, oil-producing reservoirs in Wyoming. You can see the people who participated in each. And what's interesting is if you look at the list under 10 sleep, we have some very large companies, Anadarko, Marathon, but we also have J.J. Bunkert. J.J. Bunkert operates two wells and has one employee. So we've kind of captured the whole span of Wyoming operators in our workshops. Testimonials are on the opposite page. It's interesting because when I went to meet with Marathon, Amoco and Marathon joint ventured, and we knew them well when I worked in Wyoming. And they're famous for developing water flooding technologies. And I went and talked to their regional manager, and he said, "What are you going to teach us about water flooding?" And I said, "Well, you, not much. But how much do your people less than 30 years old know about water flooding?" And he said, "You're right." So we convinced them to participate in our workshop. In fact, they helped us prepare for it, and actually Legacy and Tom helped pay for it. After the workshop was completed, Mike Ramsier, whose testimonial is listed here, we met with management, and he told management if this wasn't the best workshop he's been to in his 20-year career with Marathon, it was one of the two best. So that was a pretty good recommendation. We'll be repeating these workshops through the coming years. We limited participation so they could be interactive. So we only had 15 representatives from operating companies. So if you look at the list, we only allowed one or two people to participate from each company, and there's a lot more demand than that. Whoops. That wasn't very good, was it? So new opportunities. We update our strategic plan annually, and thank you. Sorry, I usually do this at home. Currently, we're looking at how to use methane and nitrogen to boost production as a tertiary recovery technique. We're also looking at advanced technologies for producing incremental oil from unconventional reservoirs. Primary production from unconventional reservoirs is extremely low. So when you think about the large amounts of oil being produced from the Bakken at the present time or that might be produced from our own unconventional reservoirs, typical recoveries are less than 10% of the original oil that are there. So if we could just double that with advanced techniques, that's a large amount of oil and a great use of carbon dioxide. These techniques have been researched since the 1980s. Mark Northam, who's the director of SER, worked for Mobil and actually looked at CO2 EOR for unconventional reservoirs back in the 80s. So it's a new opportunity. Unconventional oil recovery is relatively new as it is, and we plan to at least understand what's being done in North Dakota and Montana and the work that's being done at universities, including Texas and Texas A&M, and how it might be used here in Wyoming. That's the end of my presentation. Questions?
Representative Stopson.
Mr. Chairman, just building on that last point you made, I'm just curious, you know, we obviously see the impact on pricing of the unconventional oil plays and expanding supply there, I guess. And I'm just wondering, kind of broad framework, how that's impacting the economics of EOR, whether it's depressing interest in EOR going forward.
It's a very good point, Representative, Mr. Dave. Chairman. There is competition within any oil company for investment, especially the big ones. And so what we're seeing is, let's use an example of a Wyoming company that's drilling $10 million wells in the Bakken. And they have a choice. They have a set number of staff, so they can manage their $10 million well that drills in 60 days. Or they could implement a water flood or a chemical flood improvement. So given the lead time required to do enhanced oil recovery, which for a chemical flood is typically 3 years on public land, on private land, as long as 5 to 7 years on public land, investing in an unconventional well is pretty attractive because the business cycle is 18 months from the time you spud it to the time it pays out. So there is competition, and we do see we do have to keep the companies focused on these other projects, redeveloping their mature oil fields. There are companies like Denbury who just sold their interests in the Bakken who want to invest only in mature oil fields. So, you know, it's keeping everything moving, but there is clearly a competition. That's one issue. The other issue is sensitivity to oil price. So Denbury's provided numbers that indicate their cost of production with carbon dioxide EOR is in the $40 a barrel range. Some of you probably realize that unconventional production costs a lot more than that. So I've heard numbers in the $70 to $80 barrel range. So if oil prices fall, what will happen? And I think both will continue, and I think we need both because of the size of the prize here in Wyoming for mature reservoirs. But the unconventional reservoirs will be developed too. And I guess it's a healthy competition. I just like, from the Institute's perspective and the state's perspective, I'd like to make sure we remove any barrier that they may have and try to reduce the length of time required to implement a large project, so that we take some of the economic risk, the oil price risk, out of it. Did I answer your question, Rep? Thank you.
Committee, any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dockstader.
Just quickly, you referenced a permitting process of 2 to 3 years. Do you see that scenario improving at all?
Senator, I'd say it's not improving. So the best way to predict the future is to look at the past. Yeah.
Okay. I got one question. This is the architectural's rendition of the new center, correct?
That's the photograph.
That's a photograph?
Yeah. That's the real deal.
Why did we have this big space underneath the corner of the building that we could have cost so much more to build it that way, and we could have had all that more usable space there? How did this get in? I mean, you didn't have anything to do with that, but no. I'm looking underneath there, and all that space is available. Is this one of those, I'm an architect and it's going to look nice?
I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that, Mr. Chairman. But my office is right on the corner there, and there is a trap door underneath my chair. So.
Well, it's an eject where you just pull the, you know, the JAC has a button that rejects you down into the
Yeah, you guys
lot.
Have the button.
I just looked at that, and I thought, wow, you know, that's just, anyway. Okay, any other questions in general of Dave or what they're doing in terms of your staffing, and you'll get into that, but you're at the level we need to be at now, correct?
We have one open position, which is a healthy place to be, and we're near fully staffed for the first time in 3 years.
One of the things we hear is the in terms of salaries is the inability to attract and keep qualified people. I know that happens, and there's obviously opportunities that come, and there's one gentleman that you know I'm talking about went to Kansas, and
you know, there's just no way that you can sometimes compete. How are you in the market in terms of getting the kind of people you want? I think you've got some incredible people right now. Could you comment on that a little bit?
Retaining, yes, Mr. Chairman, retaining talented staff is a challenge in this market. Industry pays substantially more than university salaries. So what we've tried to do is recognize our staff and give them a wonderful working environment. The legislature and oil companies have helped fund a state-of-the-art laboratory and state-of-the-art offices. That goes a long way toward retaining and recruiting talented people. Reality is, though, that we are going to have turnover.
It's just something you manage. I mean, you understand that that's the reality of it, and you bring them along and train them, and then there will be turnover, and you manage it.
There will be, and we do manage it. I'm holding my breath for 2014. We didn't lose anybody in 2013. So a normal turnover rate for a regular business, when I was in business, we considered 10-15% turnover, not to be unusual.
I think the state's big pool is 15%.
Right. And so we were at that mark early, but lately, not at all. And what I'd like to say is that people come to work in the Institute and at the university so that they have a quality of life. That's part of the equation. And what I've found is if we take talented people, keep them challenged and excited about what they're doing, and put them in a work environment that they enjoy, it helps. And I have to say the way that we've developed collaborative projects with industry has also helped, because it's pretty remarkable what they can learn by being in operators' offices and being in the field as well as the lab in their office.
You had a lot of experience in the private sector and doing what you're doing now. You've been on board for a couple, 3 years. If you had to describe what you see in putting on your looking forward visionary hat that as to the things that we as a state could do to best help what you're trying to do, and we all recognize the huge potential of EORI, and the neat thing about it, you don't have to deal with the feds. Other than the obvious CO2, is there anything else out there that you see that we could be doing a better job of to try to help and move this further along in terms of getting the incremental barrels into production?
Mr. Chairman, I think what we need to do, we are doing, and the legislature and the JC and the Minerals Committee are supporting it, and it takes time to develop skills. So we're taking people who have worked primarily in an academic or national lab environment and introducing them to the business outside the laboratory and the office. We'll continue doing a great job in the laboratory and the office. I think the description that was provided by the Technical Advisory Board, some of our industrial partners on our tab, it's great that you do impressive, elegant work, but what we want is practical, timely work, and it costs less to do practical, timely work. So some of our younger staff are in a position where they can be trained to be more responsive to industry, but the way I think that can be best done is to let them work collaboratively with industry, and that way we also get more bang for the buck by having industry carry their share of the load. So it takes time to train people to do that. One of the more innovative things we're doing, I'm not sure how innovative it is, but we've hired one retired geologist from Shell who understands Aeolian geology, which is really important, the Menelaus and the Ten Sleep in the state. We're in the process of hiring another fellow who retired from Chevron just recently, who teaches their CO2. He still teaches Chevron CO2 EOR school. His name's Ron Wachowski. He lives in Steamboat, and he's interested. These guys are interested in staying involved, and especially in a university. So we're being creative about how we incorporate them into our teams. And then through our cooperative relationships with other universities, I think we can use it all to continue to develop the program.
Talk to me about the chain of command a little bit. There was some issues that we had, and a lot of it dealt with the School of Energy Resources about, and you report to Mark, the director of the School of Energy Resources. In the past, there was some concern about who he reported to, and there were some intermittent steps, and I think we all know what I'm talking about. And those have been changed from the short-term president we just had, but the new president, interim president, has committed to have that same chain of command. Tell me a little bit about, from your perspective, what you think about that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's good. Mark Northam, who's the director of SER, now reports directly to the president of the university. And I think as far as decision-making goes and influencing our program, that's a good thing. That's what I've seen. But we've always had a good relationship with Mark. For those of you who haven't met him, he joined the university after leaving Saudi Aramco, before that ExxonMobil, before that Mobil.
And the thing we want to be sure and do is that if you look at where the money comes from, it's appropriated by the legislature. So in my way of thinking, and maybe I'm the only one, but I think like you really work for us in the state of Wyoming.
Right.
The university there is a very important part of it to utilize the expertise and all the talent they bring to the table, but you work for us.
Yes.
And we have your budget just like Mark. And so I think that it's really going to work the way we've had it. In the past, it was not. Just wasn't working, so that's good. Okay, any other questions anybody has? Okay, let's get into your budget, and please, page by page, start at the front end, and we'll go through it.
You bet.
And if we have questions along the way, committee, please interrupt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I'd like to recognize the help we've gotten from Laura Anderson and Don Richards. Thanks, guys. It's made it a lot easier for us. We're a unique animal. I'm not sure there's anybody else who's exactly like us. Hopefully we're a successful, unique animal. I'd like to go to page 3 and just go through the budget. Our budget's divided into two spending categories, commission and support, and technical outreach and research. The bulk of our staff work is funded out of technical outreach and research. So our 19 staff are paid out of that budget. The 6 faculty and 20 or so graduate students we support are funded out of that budget, and all of our outreach is paid for out of that budget. And so what we've asked for is level funding in the new biennium at approximately $5.2 million. The other portion of the budget is to support our commission, and it provides the administrative support we have in our office. Our commission is composed of 8 participants, and we meet quarterly. We're very interactive. Bruce, who's sitting to my right, is our current chairman. He told me I could do my job up here and he could do his, so if you have any really hard questions about the budget, Bruce will answer them.
Yeah, Bruce, do you have any comments?
Mr. Chairman, thanks for the opportunity. I just would comment that the commission has worked really well with Dave and Dave with the university, so that I think that the money you all are investing in the Enhanced Oil Recovery Commission is going to real applied research that has a chance of creating benefit for the state of Wyoming in the oil fields. And I think that it's not esoteric sort of stuff that some guy just decides he wants to investigate that. I think that's necessary kind of research to be done, but in what we're trying to do here, we need real applied research that will get the rubber on the road and get oil out of the ground, and I think that that's what we've been able to do.
Any questions, Bruce? You going to stick around for the Oil and Gas Commission hearing the budget as well? You're going to leave?
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't going to stick
around. Yeah. You know, I think I just want to recognize, Bruce, for your service. You all have now completed 6 years on the commission, and you spent on the Oil and Gas Commission, and you spent as a representative for that commission on ERI. You've done it for 4 years. 4 years. So, you know, and Bruce had a good training like I did. He was Shell Oil. But we want to thank you for your service. It's not easy, and it takes a lot of time. I know you're highly compensated for the time you put into it. Look at that smile on his face. But thank you, Bruce, for your hard work for our state. I know you love Wyoming like we all do, and we really appreciate the job you've done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, go on with the budget.
So I've done an overview of the budget. The details in the rest of the budget document I've really already presented. Unless
that's not going to work, Dave. Go through the budget and get to the part we want to hear about your expanded budget, what you've got there, the $111,000, and curious why the governor turned it down. And
basically, okay, so we're a unique organization. We report to the commission and the legislature. We're employees of the university, and our commission has said that we'll request the same pay increases that the university requests for their staff. And that's where the $111,000 came from. It equates to the 4% raise that the university requested in their budget request. The governor didn't approve it, but we were told it would all be put into a package, and the legislature.
And you bought into that, huh?
The legislature will decide what kind of raise our staff may get. So that's where the $111,000 came
from. Any questions on that, committee? Okay, continue. The commission meets four times a year, correct?
It does. Page 13, there's an organization chart. And it basically indicates how the commission reports through the legislature to the governor. We're employees of the state of the University of Wyoming, but we work with and for operators, Wyoming operators. I've described the commission. We have a technical advisory board that currently has 12 members. We're fortunate because three of them are members of the National Academy of Engineering. Most universities might have one member of the National Academy on staff. The three we have are Paul Wilhite, who is my mentor, Gary Pope, Paul's from the University of Kansas, Gary Pope, University of Texas, who's participating in our meeting for the first time in several years next week, and George Hirasaki, who's from Rice University. The TAB also has members of large operating and small operating companies, including True, Merit, Anadarko, Marathon, who have I left out? Denbury. And what they do is review our program and provide updates twice a year. So we meet with the commission four times a year. We meet with the TAB twice a year. I think I've described all the moving parts, and the budget isn't terribly complicated. What other individual pages are you interested in, Mr. Chairman?
Your budget.
Yeah.
No, I think we're in good shape. Any questions, committee, on the budget? I think who in the House deals with it, Representative Stubson and myself, have the responsibility for these budgets, so we'll be carrying them on the floor, and any information, if we need some, Dave, we'll let you know any questions that might come up, but I think it's pretty straightforward. And, you know, the one thing that you've done, and I think maybe, Tim, you'd like this as well, that would, you know, it's a cost-benefit ratio, and I've talked about this a lot, is, you know, the amount of money we spend relative to the amount of money we receive. And, you know, you can look at it as $5 million to $150 million, and some numbers on the incremental oil we've increased. You know, and the thing about it, that's sustained.
Yes.
And so, we talk about, I know tourism talks about a dollar that rolls in, we get eight times it and all that. It'd be interesting to do how much for every dollar invested in EORI. And it's not just because of EORI that we have the tertiary, but you're a big part of it. How much that, what that ratio, and just work out some things to provide that to us, the cost benefits.
There is an example in the budget, Mr. Chairman, that estimates the tax revenue, just the ad valorem and severance tax from the 21 million barrels of oil equates to about $150 million over the next 20 years. The last 10 years, it's cost about $30 million to fund URI. So what I would say is we've netted positive $120 million, and I've run my own company. If I was given that opportunity, I'd probably invest in it.
I think we all would. Okay. Any other questions? Any other questions we have of any of the activities? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Committee, it's 20 till 12, and thanks to Mr. Co-Chair talking to me yesterday about how to run a meeting, we're ahead of schedule. And we will fire up. You got something else to add, Mr. Co-Chair?
I'm glad you listened.
We will be back here, I think, Grant, Oil and Gas Commission's on at 1 o'clock.